Good evening. I'd like to call to order the Oro Valley Town Council regular session. Mr. Standish, roll call, please.
Vice Mayor Barrett.
Here.
Councilmember Bowen.
Here.
Councilmember Green.
Here.
Councilmember Jones Ivy.
Here.
Councilmember Nicholson.
Here.
Councilmember Solomon.
Here.
And Mayor Winfield.
Here. Let the record show that all council members are present, and Council Member Nicholson is joining us by Zoom. I move to go into executive session with the town magistrate, town attorney, town clerk, and if necessary, the human resources director and town manager.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed, nay. The ayes have it, 7-0. So the majority of you weren't here earlier this evening when we convened our regular session. So you may be wondering why I'm reconvening, but we're reconvening the regular session tonight for the Oro Valley Town Council regular session, September 7th, 2022. So we welcome you, and we're grateful that you're here with us this evening. I'd like to ask Mr. Standish for roll call.
Vice Mayor Barrett.
Here.
Councilmember Bowen.
Here.
Councilmember Green.
Here.
Councilmember Jones Ivy.
Here.
Councilmember Nicholson.
Here.
Councilmember Solomon.
Here.
And Mayor Winfield.
Here. For the record, all members of council are present. Councilmember Nicholson is joining us by Zoom. We did meet in the executive session earlier regarding the town magistrate's contract. Mr. Standish, would you please read item one?
For direction to the town manager and or necessary staff as discussed in executive session pertaining to the town magistrate contract discussion.
And Mr. Rothschild, would you please read the motion?
Yes, the proposed motion would be that the town magistrate be allowed to reduce his work schedule to 26.5 hours per week through the staffing agency Staffing Matters as an exempt employee. The town magistrate would be available 24 hours a day to respond to the needs of the community. There would be a reduction in compensation to $114,563.58, and there would be an insurance stipend of $10,569.36. This will result in a savings to the town of $34,841.80, and that the manager and town council be authorized to enter into a contract with staffing matters with the town with the town magistrate as a agent of staffing matters.
So moved.
Second.
Seconded by Vice Mayor Barrett. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Nay. The ayes have it, 7-0. You know, this evening we're joined by members of the Daughters of the American Revolution, and it's going to be our privilege to let them lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance this evening. So if you'd please stand for the allegiance, Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. And we appreciate that you're here with us this evening, and they'll be part of the program a little later. We have Mr. Standish to announce upcoming meetings.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. There will be a neighborhood meeting for the Mercado del Rio self-storage on September 8th at 6 p.m. here in the council chambers and also via Zoom. The Water Utility Commission will be holding their next regular session meeting on September 12th at 5 p.m. in the Hopi Conference Room. There will be another neighborhood meeting for Miller Ranch Self-Storage on September 12th at 6 p.m. in the Council Chambers and via Zoom. And then the Stormwater Utility Commission meeting will be held on September 15th at 4 p.m. in the Hopi Conference Room. The Budget and Finance Commission will hold their next regular session on September 20th at 4 p.m. here in the Council Chambers. And then the September 20th Parks and Recreation Advisory Board meeting has been canceled. And then lastly, the Town Council's next regular session is scheduled for September 21st at 6 p.m. here in the Council Chambers. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Standish. Normally we have those meetings shown on the screen. Tonight we didn't, and so you have my apologies for that. But we appreciate Mr. Standish making those announcements. There we go. Ask and it appears. Thanks. So do we have council reports this evening? Councilmember Jones-Ivy?
Oops. Can you hear me now? I think I've got my finger on the right button. Okay. A new ski year has started, and Project Grad is definitely in the works. I just want to announce that there is going to be a 2022 Clue Murder Mystery fundraiser. The actual event is October 7th. The last time you can get your tickets will be It's closed already. Anyway, if you want to make a donation, I'm going to encourage you to do that. Again, this event is going to be October 7th. You can certainly make contributions to CDO PG fundraising, and you can certainly do that online. They're also in need of volunteers for the big graduation night, and if you give me a minute, I'm going to pull up those dates because there are volunteer dates coming up. And I also want to remind you that this is an opportunity for us to continue providing our young graduates a very safe and sane graduation. So we've got upcoming dates for meetings, September 21st, which is coming up soon, October 19th, November 16th, January 25th, February 15th, March 29th, and April 19th. Please contact them. We definitely need you to volunteer. And because the price of things are increasing in leaps and bounds, their target for fundraising has almost doubled. So I want to encourage each one of you to please make that commitment to our young people. Thank you.
Other council reports this evening? Councilmember Green?
I had the pleasure of attending the last day of summer camp at the community center, and it was absolutely fantastic. You could be the most depressed person in the world, or you watch those kids that day, and you would be the happiest person. I just want to commend Christy and her staff for doing a tremendous job with the summer camps. The other thing that I'd like to bring up is the stormwater utility. We had one stranded vehicle that I know about, which is a record for us, a record low. And a lot of that is due to the fact of the stormwater people getting on the TV and warning people about what's happening during the monsoon. And so that was a very proactive and important thing for them to do.
Okay. Vice Mayor Barrett.
Thank you. Just this last week, six of us had the opportunity to attend a conference in Phoenix, the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. So that was an opportunity for all of us to learn and continue to learn about the ongoing changes in government and laws that affect government, and to have opportunities to learn how to serve you better. So I think that was informative for all of us, and I just wanted to report on that. And you may have more to add, Mr. Mayor, but that's all I'll say. Thanks.
Any other reports this evening? Okay, seeing none, I'll invite Ms. Jacobs will present her report.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of council, and welcome back to fall. I wanted to let our community know that it's time for this year's Community Academy again. This twice-weekly, four-week class provides a great opportunity to learn about Oro Valley, your local government, and features a great lineup of presenters from town staff. So sign up by October 1st. We will this year provide both an in-person and a remote option for participation to accommodate all of our residents here in the community, and you can find more information about that on the town's website. Also, last month, the Arizona chapter of the American Planning Association recognized the town for developing model policies to best ensure conservation of saguaros, which, of course, are so important in our community and region. The model policy was recognized within this professional planning community as a model for other Sonoran Desert communities to emulate, and I'd like to congratulate Planning Manager Bayer Vela and his entire team for their great work and for this recognition. I also invite our community to pick up the copy next week of the Explorer because it will include our entire fall recreation schedule, or you can go to playov.com. The great list of fall camps, classes, events to sign up for or to add to your calendar, including some exciting holiday events again this year. And finally, I'd also like to invite our residents to tune in to this month's This is Oro Valley podcast, where Chief Riley and Lieutenant Teachout discuss critical community safety issues and the police department's robust training, their preparation, and their outreach efforts. It's really an excellent podcast, and I think you'd learn a lot. And next month's podcast is going to be on birding, as I talk with the executive director of the Tucson Audubon Society, and this is part of the town's efforts to broaden its tourism. And with that, Mr. Mayor, I'll turn that back over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jacobs. We appreciate that report. I've had the opportunity to review the order of the meeting, Council, and I'd like to make a recommendation that item 3, which is discussion regarding light pole protocols at Naranja Park, be moved to the end of the agenda. Are there any objections to that change in tonight's order of agenda items? Seeing and hearing no objections, we'll make that change to the agenda. Item 3 will go to the end. Again, I'd like to welcome each of you who've joined us this evening. It shows your interest in our community, and we recognize and appreciate that very much. We'll now go to a call to audience. A call to audience is the opportunity for members of the public to speak pursuant to the Arizona Open Meeting Law. Mayor and council are not allowed to discuss, respond to, or take legal action on matters raised during call to audience. At the conclusion of call to audience, council members may direct town staff to review the matter, ask that the matter be placed on a future agenda, or respond to criticism made by speakers. I'd like to invite Mr. Tim Terrace.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, Vice Mayor Barrett, council and town officials. My name is Tim Terrace, and with me is Ann Young. Both of us are Oro Valley residents, and we both live on properties adjoining the Oro Valley Church of the Nazarene. Ann has been in her home for 45 years, and we have been in our home for 29 years. We are speaking tonight in the continuing effort by the neighbors known as the Concordia Buena Vista Group to oppose a rezone request by the Oro Valley Church of the Nazarene. Practical reasons for the rezone are few, but logical reasons against are many. We know you are aware of our opposition and the various reasons for our position. I would like to add information to that collection. This morning, my wife and I took our granddaughters to school at Basis on North Oracle. While driving on Calle Concordia, Calle Buena Vista, and Linda Vista to Oracle Road, we encountered the usual walkers and bikers. Today, however, we also encountered many members of the Canyon de Oro cross-country team doing their morning regiment. They were carefully observing traffic and sharing the road well with vehicular traffic. The proposal by OVCN, by their own admission, will bring 4 to 5 times the existing vehicular traffic 7 days a week. There is no logical reason to increase the likelihood of accident, injury, or worse on the neighborhood or our youth. Please deny the rezone request by OVCN when presented. We are talking about our homes, neighborhood, and community, while they are talking about a commercial level enterprise. On behalf of the entire Concordia Buena Vista Group, Ann and I thank you for your time.
Excuse me. Mr. Mike Zinkin.
Mike Zinkin, Oro Valley resident. First of all, I want to congratulate the incumbents who were just reelected. Now let me get on, let the shoe drop. In a recent communication from the town, I inquired where the money came to spend over $620,000 to redo the council chamber. I was told it came from the $5.3 million supplied by the CARES Act funding. I was told it was approved by council and was in the fiscal 2021 adopted budget. That's not true. The fiscal 2021 CIP, Capital Improvement Program, allows for $105,000 for council chamber AV improvements and $55,000 for furniture. That's about $160,000, not $620,000. There was no authorization to spend the money, but it was spent. The July 7th, 2021 council minutes denote approved projects for Naranja Park as a result of the $25 million bond. Wi-Fi was never mentioned. Where did Jacobs get the authority to spend our money for Wi-Fi? The Wi-Fi costs about $123,000. The money coming from the HOA is about $125,000. So is that HOA money that put Wi-Fi at Naranja instead of putting it to golf like it's supposed to go? The April 6, 2022 council minutes note that there was a motion passed 7-0 to ask town staff to bring a proposal to, quote, ask town staff to bring us a proposal to add an elevator or appropriate technology to the existing building in the most cost-effective way while keeping the existing entrances, restaurant location, and building functions, and make it a priority from the existing community center funds and the $750,000 set aside for this purpose, unquote. That was 6 months ago. What happened to the priority? The council minutes of May 18, 2022 show that there were three attempts to get staff to bring a list of the Naranja projects along with the associated costs, and it never passed. The seven of you don't think that the 44,000 people in this town want to know an itemization of the projects at Naranja? There's an unsubstantiated rumor that a couple of you are asked by Jacobs what your wish was for Naranja. If that's true, your answer should have been, we spent the people's money for a survey to establish their desired amenities, therefore my wish is to fulfill their desires. Wi-Fi was not one of their desires. You people need to take control of this town back from Jacobs and the staff. Stop the unauthorized spending, which is a direct violation of Town Policy 6. And also, why is unauthorized spending taking precedence over authorized spending? Now, I've asked you a bunch of questions, and I'm wondering who's going to answer them. And so in about 2 minutes in your inbox, this is going to be there along with the minutes that I have mentioned. Thank you.
So I have a blue card, and there's some question as to whether this is a call to audience blue card or you're wanting to speak to item two on the agenda. Sue Renand, are you wanting to?
I wanted to just give my opinion about the project that's going on.
Which project is that? Okay, so that's item two. So that is later. Okay.
Mr. Mayor.
Councilmember Solomon.
Yes, according to the rules of the call to audience, at the conclusion, individual council members may ask that a matter be placed on future agenda. I would request that a future agenda item, a detailed budget and costs of all the different improvements being done at Naranja Park be presented to the council.
Okay. Second?
I would second that.
Yeah, I've seconded it. But.
And one other item, that staff present a report on the status and proposals for the ADA improvements at the community center.
Second.
you second.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There are some other matters that Mr. Zinkin will be getting an email if that could be reviewed by staff and responded to. Okay, thank you. So I have no other blue cards at this time, so we'll close call to audience. We'll go to the presentations part of our agenda this evening. Mr. Standish, item one of presentations.
Proclamation, Constitution Week.
Okay, so it's my privilege to read the following proclamation. Whereas September 17th, 2022 marks the 235th anniversary of the drafting of the Constitution of the United States of America by the Constitutional Convention, and it is fitting and proper to accord official recognition to this magnificent document and its memorable anniversary into the patriotic celebrations which will commemorate the occasion. And whereas Public Law 915 guarantees the issuing of a proclamation each year by the President of the United States of America designating September 17th through the 23rd as Constitution Week, now therefore I, Joseph C. Winfield, Mayor of Oro Valley, do hereby proclaim the week of September 17th through the 23rd as Constitution Week, and ask our residents to reaffirm the ideals that the framers of the Constitution held in 1787 by vigilantly protecting the freedoms guaranteed to us through this guardian of our liberties, remembering that lost rights may never be regained. Dated this, the 7th day of September, 2022. This evening, Penny Simon Nielsen will accept the proclamation. And it's my pleasure to present this proclamation to you, and we appreciate you being here this evening. I think there'll be a photo, and then I'd like to invite you to say a few words. So, Penny, if you would please introduce some of the others that are here this evening with you, okay, and then...
We have the Kachina Society, Children of the American Revolution. Could you please stand? And the president of the Kachina Society. They've come tonight to help, as you know, pass out the preamble to the Constitution, bookmarks, and flags. And we thank you. I am the regent of the El Presidio chapter, Daughters of the American Revolution. Our chapter has over 140 members, most of which live in the Oro Valley area. We are a nonprofit, non-political women's volunteer service organization. We have served the Oro Valley area for over 30 years by participating in community events such as Annual First Responders Day, Earth Day, Wreaths Across America, JROTC recognition, book donations to local schools, and we support veterans in the area of providing lap robes, Christmas cards, and gifts, as well as preparing meals for Fisher House and decorating the house for Christmas. Constitution Week was started by the Daughters of the American Revolution in 1955 when the National Society, Daughters of the American Revolution, petitioned Congress to set aside September 17 through 23 annually to be dedicated for the observance of Constitution Week. The resolution was adopted by the U.S. Congress and signed into law by President Dwight D. Eisenhower in August 1956. The Constitution is a living document that assures each citizen of the freedoms Americans cherish and appreciate. As members of the Daughters of the American Revolution, it is our responsibility to keep our ancestors' legacy alive by promoting the ideals they fought valiantly to give their descendants. Tonight, on behalf of the Daughters of the American Revolution, I would like to thank the Kachina Society children, as we did earlier, I would also like to thank the members of my chapter for being here to witness this event. And I'd like to thank the Oro Valley Police Volunteers, the CVAP group, which I am a part of, for their support of me tonight by attending this proclamation presentation. And lastly, thank you, Mayor Winfield and Town Council, for your leadership in our community and for supporting the El Presidio chapter by signing a proclamation proclaiming September 17 through 23 as Constitution Week. Thank you.
Could all the members of CVAP that are here this evening, would you just stand so that we can recognize you? Okay, nice. Well, thank you so much. Mr. Standish, presentation 2.
Proclamation, National Preparedness Month.
So it's my pleasure to read the following proclamation. Whereas across the nation, September has been designated as National Preparedness Month to encourage all Americans to improve emergency preparedness in their communities. And during National Preparedness Month, there is a nationwide coordinated effort sponsored by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to raise awareness about the importance of emergency preparedness and to encourage every citizen to renew their commitment to promoting emergency preparedness in homes, businesses, schools, and communities. And emergency preparedness is the responsibility of every resident of Oro Valley. And all are urged to make preparedness a priority and take steps to protect our community before disaster strikes by learning about risk factors in order to protect against injuries, property damage, and potential economic loss in our community caused during disasters. And whereas emergency preparedness is the during the month of September, the town of Oro Valley, Oro Valley Community Emergency Response Team, Pima County Office of Emergency Management, along with other local, tribal, private, and volunteer agencies, will engage in activities that encourage residents to take steps to make themselves and their families more resilient and better prepared for disasters and emergencies. Now, therefore, I, Joseph C. Winfield, Mayor of the Town of Oro Valley, Arizona, hereby proclaim the month of September 2022 to be Preparedness Month. This year's National Preparedness Month theme is a lasting legacy. The life you've built is worth protecting. Prepare for disasters to create a lasting legacy for you and your family. Citizens, businesses, schools, and communities are able to help first responders in our community by training how to respond during an emergency and planning what to do when disaster strikes, where we live, work, and visit. Developing individualized plans, assembling emergency supply kits, learning life-saving skills such as CPR and first aid, reviewing insurance policies and coverage for hazards, and reviewing the resources available at www.ready.gov help ensure a resilient and prepared Oro Valley. Dated this 7th day of December, September 2022, I'd like to invite our regional emergency response planner, Louis Valenzuela, and he'll accept this proclamation this evening.
Good evening, Mayor and Council, Town Manager and staff. Thank you so much for your commitment to emergency preparedness in the town of Oro Valley. Emergency preparedness is no accident. It's a continuous cycle of being informed, of training, of exercising, and updating those plans on a continuous basis, whether you are in local government or you are in a household. So we certainly encourage everybody to take life safety training, first aid, AEDs. It's a great time of the year to do that. A prepared community is a resilient community, and as a representative of the town, I look forward to supporting those efforts as much as we are available. Thank you.
and Mr. Mayor, Council, members of the public, I just want to take the opportunity as your Chief Innovation Officer to just give Louis just a lot of credit for his position. So as Chief Innovation Officer, the Emergency Management Department reports up through me. Louis has been fantastic. He has deep ties in the community in Pima County, and he's just made us a superstar in this area. So thank you, Louis.
Okay, Mr. Standish, number three presentation.
Proclamation, National IT Professionals Day.
So this is the evening of proclamations. Let's see. Whereas it is with acknowledgement and appreciation of the technical experts, network engineers, system administrators, database administrators, business systems analysts, GIS analysts, and service desk technicians who ensure our networks, applications, tools, technology, and information are kept secure, ensuring technical processes, systems, and devices operate smoothly, and the Town of Oro Valley recognizes the importance and benefits of IT professionals as an integral role, enriching the lives of our community members, securing a desirable place to live, work, play, and visit. And the Town of Oro Valley supports the skilled work of IT professionals to strengthen community, communication, and resiliency, connect people with technology and each other, and provide and promote opportunities for healthy living, equity, and sustainability. And whereas the Town of Oro Valley has designated the third Tuesday of each September as National IT Professionals Day. Now, therefore, I, Joseph C. Winfield, Mayor of the Town of Oro Valley, Arizona, hereby proclaim that September 20th, 2022 shall be known as National IT Professionals Day. And I'd like to invite Chuck Boyer, who's our Chief Information Officer, to come forward, and he will accept the proclamation.
Again, thank you very much. Gosh, IT just underlies everything that the town does. And, you know, we're very privileged to have a very skilled staff. If my team that's here tonight would stand up, go ahead. Guys in the back. No IT people like to be recognized, but here they are. This is just a fraction of the folks that it takes to put on these things, to make all this technology work, to make sure your email's running. And thank you very much for the recognition.
Absolutely. It's certainly well-deserved. Ms. Jacobs, would you like to just speak to Chuck's important role here as part of your executive team?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of council. You know, our IT team is truly the backbone of everything that we do in this organization. And under Chuck's leadership, they have grown and innovated and moved us forward, not to mention keeping all of the things that we do safe every single day. And I believe that we have one of the best IT teams in local government in the state of Arizona. We are so proud to recognize them and all of their work that they do today. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
I couldn't agree more. We'll go to the consent agenda. I move to approve the consent agenda.
I'll second.
Seconded by Councilmember Solomon. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The ayes have it, 7-0. We'll go to the regular agenda, item 2.
Discussion and possible action regarding a conceptual site and landscape plan for a proposed 64-lot subdivision known as Naranja Trails, located south of the Naranja Drive and Highlands Wash intersection, approximately a quarter mile west of North First Avenue.
Thank you, Mr. Standish. This evening, Planning Manager Bayer Vella will present this item. Mr. Vella, do we have any other presentations other than what you'll be doing tonight?
Yes, sir. Mayor, Council, This will actually be a shared presentation between myself and Mr. Paul Kiesler, town engineer. And following that, I'm aware the applicant has a presentation as well.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Mayor, Council, this is a significant event for the neighboring property owners as well as the property owner. And I really want to punctuate that fact by there have been multiple proposals over the years. Over the last 10 years, there have been multiple proposals. The history goes well back to the 1980s. This proposal is the first to move this far forward. So where we are today is a proposal. If I may, next slide. Clicker's not keeping up with me. Thank you. So a quick overview of the proposal this evening. There are some 64 lots planned for development. Some 61 of those are oriented toward model homes, and three are oriented and sized appropriately for custom homes. Thank you. Other key features of the site is that there are two main access points, Naranja Drive, as well as limited access to Shorecliff. Perhaps the most prominent feature of this design and the reason that the town engineer is going to spend quite a bit of time this evening taking a deep dive on different drainage components is addressing a longstanding regional, not a local, but a regional drainage issue and a proposed improvement. Want to punctuate as part of the overview is that the proposal before you meets all zoning requirements of the River's Edge Planned Area Development, and the Planning and Zoning Commission recommended conditional approval on August 4th. And a bit later in the presentation, I'm going to talk about those specific conditions and the fact that they've been incorporated in the proposal before you. I think all the neighbors, and I certainly know as well as council, are aware of the location of the site. It's outlined in blue on the slide here. It's roughly bordered by Naranja Drive and Highlands Mobile Home Park, and surrounded on all sides by development, existing development, and some perhaps quarter mile, bit more, crows fly away from First Avenue. What's, I think, really important about this location map is actually the black outline. The black outline, you know, indicates an area back in the 80s as well as in the mid-90s where Pima County planned for this entire area comprehensively. All of the zoning within this black area was assigned in one fell swoop in a planned community, again, approved by Pima County and the Board of Supervisors, well before this property was annexed by Oro Valley. I mentioned, you know, a lot of development activity and proposals over the last 10 years, but the history, as I've already alluded to, goes way well back before then. And I think it's foundational to understand, and I certainly believe the neighborhood, folks who participate in the neighborhood meeting certainly understand and become to appreciate that the zoning has already been set. So the question of yes or no, whether a subdivision may go here, has already been answered. It was answered by Pima County to their standards in 1985. And in fact, a design called a general development plan with a cluster option, Pima County cluster option, using Pima County code, frozen in effect of that date back in 94, was all incorporated for an approval for a general development plan. Fast forward a whole year to 1995, and the town annexed the property. And a key component of the annexation discussion was for the property owner to be annexed was to come into the town with respect for the current, back then, Pima County CR2 zoning standards, as well as the cluster development plan that was approved and indicated in the middle of the slide. That design was pre-approved by Pima County and formulated and embedded in town zoning. And I really want to take a moment because there were quite a few very good questions through the neighborhood meeting process as well as at the Planning and Zoning Commission about what are the most important components of that zoning that that we're working with today and trying to make this design the best that it can be within the existing rights. First off, and I want to direct everyone to look to the right side of the screen, the most foundational component of the zoning document is the reflection that Pima County zoning standards shall prevail. PAD specifies town standards as a backup designation, but unusually in this PAD, it really pinpoints and makes clear that the Pima County zoning standards prevail. Two very often asked questions, again, at neighborhood meetings and commission are, well, how many lots are really allowed here? And what are the minimum lot sizes? Well, the answer, again, is in Pima County CR2 zoning, frozen in time back in 1994, the standards in use in 1994. Those standards in zoning lay out how much density is actually permitted. That number is well above 64. Well above 64. And you can see the math on the slide. The second question that's often asked is the minimum lot size. Why are these lots smaller than 16,000 square feet when CR2 zoning says the minimum is 16,000 square feet? Pima County's cluster development option, not the town's standards. Pima County's standards, CR2, allow a cluster development option where there is no minimum lot size if the lots are sewered. And you can see the quote from the planned area development. So the that reduced lot size is reflected in the plan in the center of the screen. So those all of those lots are well below 16,000 square feet. The PAD, in fact, envisioned the potential for 5,000 square foot lots. And what's before you is the smallest lot, the minimum lot size is some 6,600 square feet. All right, so I wanted to take a moment and compare 1994 to today, 2022. So the charge of staff throughout this process, as well as the charge for town council this evening, is the question is, how do these marry up? Do they marry up? The size and shape are essentially the same. The plan on the left has 61 lots in it. And the plan on the right has 64 lots in it. Again, well underneath the density permitted. The layout on the right has been improved to pull more lots off of hillsides, tucking more light, more lots further away from Highlands Wash. And the aim was to improve within the context of the allowances in the PAD, the design from 1994. All right, at this point, I'd like to hand it over to Mr. Kiesler to continue to discuss the foundational components of drainage, flooding, floodplain, as well as traffic. Mr. Kiesler.
Thank you, Mr. Vella, Mayor and Council. Good evening. So let me start off with a little some foundational elements on this project. I think it's no mystery, and certainly no mystery to all of the residents who are either here or watching remotely, that this project has gone around a few times, I think around 9 years or so. We've seen different variations of this periodically. One of the main components that made this a difficult project was, of course, the floodplain and dealing with Highlands Wash. Highlands Wash carries about 2,000 cubic feet per second. That's quite a bit of water that comes underneath Naranja, shoots down to the south, of course, and then ultimately discharges and goes through the Highlands Mobile Home Park. And that 2,000 cubic feet per second is in the 100-year flood. Now, the problem had been one of mathematics, actually. So part of the town's code is when you impact a floodplain, if you don't own both sides of that floodplain, if you build into it, you can only raise that floodplain by 1/10 of a foot or less. So as you build into it, you squeeze the floodplain down, and that causes the water surface elevation to go up. Well, that had been the conundrum, and that had been the difficulty for this project for some time. Now, with this current proposal, that's actually been solved, and I want to run through how that was solved. So there's no mystery for the public, and there's no mystery for anybody else who's interested in the project. And that is, hopefully, this right here represents the existing floodplain. And you can see it kind of skirts along. Could we clear that just for a sec? You can see it skirts along the west edge of the subdivision. About the southern point of that area that I just drew, the floodplain in its natural state goes into some braids that go roughly in this trajectory. There's a few braids that go through there. There's also a basin that collects from the subdivision to the east. So there's a lot of things happening right there with respect to the floodplain. Well, that was the mathematical conundrum because of the breadth of that floodplain, to build in it, to build this around the southern half, it was encroaching into the floodplain. It was causing that mathematical problem with respect to raising the floodplain waters too much. Well, the way this has been solved is through a retention basin. So I want to go through that and talk about the spatial relationship between the subdivision, the wash, and the basin. So as you can see, right about the point where the wash was going to turn back east towards the subdivision, it's actually being intercepted by this very, very large basin. That basin holds a grand total of about 10 acre feet. That's roughly 200,000 square feet. Think the size of Walmart out at the Oro Valley Marketplace. So it's a very large basin. It takes a lot of water. By doing so, what they've essentially done is they've moved the floodplain into the basin. So they're no longer building in the floodplain. The basin and the existing floodplain, they all work as a unit. So now, and I've heard some concerns from folks that this is actually, this new subdivision is being built in the floodplain. That's a bit of a misnomer if the basin goes in, because the basin actually becomes the floodplain. So they're building adjacent to it. They're not building in it. The other portion of this, and I'm going to go into this as we go more into slides here, is what does this basin do not only for this development, because this basin is sized many times larger than was ever needed for the post-development flow from just this development, but what it does for those folks south, and that would be the Highlands Mobile Home Park, and then ultimately discharging out to the CDO underneath the Lambert. So here is here's kind of a, on the exhibit to the left, it's a bit of a hodgepodge of who owns what out there with respect to Highlands Wash. Highlands Wash originates up in Rancho Vistoso. You can see that there are with third party, essentially private ownership of portions of the wash. There's Pima County ownership portions of the wash. And there's Town of Oro Valley sections of the wash that we actually are in charge of controlling. Through this development, one of the things that staff has worked out with the developer is that the town would be taking over the basin. So they'd be dedicating the basin, and I believe, Mr. Olin, the wash as well. So both pieces. So it will actually connect what's publicly run to the north, all the way south to the north end of the mobile home park. So it'll be a contiguous public management. There is no increased flow due to the proposed development because of the sizing of this basin. The proposed development produces just roughly, say, Dennis, what was that? 3 acre feet? 2 acres.
The upstream Push Ridge Vista and the new development is about 3.5 acre feet.
About 3.5 acre feet. This basin, as I mentioned, is 10 acre feet. So you can see from two whole subdivisions, we have a lot of extra space in this basin. So the basin, one, is going to be constructed by the developer, dedicated to the town for the town management and maintenance. And there's reason for that, because this is all on the land of a 64-lot subdivision. They will not have the resources moving into the future to maintain it. And it makes it all part of, again, that uniform public control and management from even farther north than this development. It reduces the runoff during the 100-year storm by 3%. Now, that's not a lot, particularly for the mobile home park, because most of the mobile home park is actually in floodplain in the 100-year storm. This basin is not the savior of this, but it does make things a whole lot better for three main reasons. Those three main reasons are, one, it acts as, I'll use an analogy, a shock absorber. So all that energy from that 2,000 CFS that's running south straight at the mobile home park, it gets into a big basin, it loses its energy. As it discharges out of the basin, it discharges out at a manageable flow. Although the intensity is still the same, it's not coming through with the same ferocity that it did without the basin. The second thing, it acts as a huge collection for sediment. As you can see from the how far Highlands Wash goes up through the desert here, it does gather a lot of sand. So that sand gets deposited in the basin instead of being deposited in the mobile home park, thus decreasing the capacity of their existing channel to manage their flow. So that's a win-win for not only the town, but also the mobile home park. The last thing is with regard to the discharge out into the CDO. Again, when you cleanse that water, you cleanse that sand out of the water, you decrease the capability of creating sandbars into the CDO, which become problematic, because then we work with the county to periodically get those cleaned out. So the more that we can keep this as a laminar flow, we keep it as a good stable system in which we're pulling out the sand in a very regimented and controlled way, that turns out to be just a regional benefit in general. And that's why your public works staff supports that the town should maintain and operate that. With regard to the mobile home park, the basin actually will hold back that 10 acre feet, and then it will discharge beyond that. So what that means is that any storm up to about a 2-year storm, that's a 50% possibility. And just to put it in layman's terms, think of a really bad monsoon. Really bad monsoon is going to be a good 2-year storm. It will hold all of that water. None of that water is going to get down through the mobile home park. And then what it will do is it will dissipate through infiltration through the basin. And again, as the town is the managing operator of the basin, if it doesn't clear out in our code prescribed 12 hours, we can throw dunks in it, we can go back in after the fact, and we can scarify the bottom. We can do those things that keep it infiltrating and discharging its water that it holds. As we met out in the field, I just wanted to go a little bit over the trajectory, and we talked about this in the beginning of my presentation. You know, we have the three main 10x5 box culverts underneath the Ranha. That water shoots out towards the southwest. That's where most of the velocity, that's where most of the head cutting is, and it's a very concentrated flow. So that's not being pointed towards the subdivision that's being proposed tonight. And again, we're using the basin as the intercept for that. Please, Claire. The last thing I really want to talk about is from a practical standpoint along the backside of the homes, because the homes are being placed at the toe of the slope where the neighborhood to the east is that there will be a constructed and managed hardened drainage way. All that flow flows south. It's going to go through a drainage way that will have to not only meet geotechnical requirements, but also drainage requirements. And again, it's going to be built out of concrete and rock, and it's going to be, again, hardened to handle the flow to keep the erosive properties away from the toe of that slope. With that, that's really clear, please. That's really what I have to say about the drainage. The drainage is being managed, and there are downstream benefits, particularly for the mobile home park. Doesn't solve all of their problems, but it does take a good bite out of what they're already facing today without this project. Moving on to traffic, this exhibit really kind of exemplifies how small this subdivision is in comparison to everybody else. That's what these circles are. 187 homes down in the Monte del Oro. We got 522 up in Montara Hills, Montara Vista. 88 over here in Catalina Ridge and River's Edge. Now, they all have north-south ingress, egress, access to Naranja, access to Lambert. But what will the traffic of this particular subdivision, what will it produce? Well, here's just by the numbers. The existing volume on Naranja, as calculated in 2021, is approximately 8,600 vehicles per day. This subdivision that's being proposed will generate around 670 vehicles per day. That's roughly 5.5 trips per house per day. That's a very conservative number. Usually on larger subdivisions, we use about 9.7 trips per day. And to kind of, again, pull this down in layman's terms, every trip in, every trip out is a trip. Just say you have a house of two people that work, go to the grocery store and go to the gym after work. Well, there's eight trips right there. Both going to work, both coming home, four. Going to the grocery store, coming back, that's six. Going to the gym, coming back, that's eight. And that's very easy. Now, you get families in there, you're going to get more, but it all equates out to about 10.5 trips per household. And again, those are ITE numbers and very, very conservative. What does that do and what does that mean for Naranja? Well, as we initially spoke and how this has been analyzed, it was been analyzed through a traffic impact analysis. That analysis looked at ingress-egress off of Naranja and egress only off of Shorecliff. With that, you have just under 500 vehicles per day, which will be actually impacting Naranja. And what that would be is a 5.7% increase in total traffic. So what does that 5.7 mean? Well, Naranja itself is still way under capacity. That congestion capacity level for Naranja is almost 1,600 vehicles per day. So you can see that Naranja is still running at, 60-65% of what its total capacity is. And that's at running at a full congestion. That's not at a standstill. That's not a parking lot. That just means a level of service D. So with that, what I'm trying to just emphasize here is that the subdivision's not making traffic that causes concern, although there are some warrants that we looked at, and that is turn lanes. So there is not a need that didn't meet warrant for the requirement for a right turn lane in off of Naranja. And Naranja also has a fairly good shoulder on the south side, which will need to be moved because a warrant was met for a left turn lane. So they'll be widening Naranja, widening it to the south, maintaining the north curb line to go ahead and put that center turn lane to be able to make a safe left. And with that, please clear. I'm going to hand the presentation back to Mr. Vella.
Mayor and Council, the public outreach for this project incorporated two neighborhood meetings, and you can see the list of common themes and well-founded concerns by the neighbors. And my hope is that the presentation this evening helped provide additional information for each. One thing the slide is missing in terms of outreach is, I really want to make sure it's punctuated, is that the Stormwater Division met with the Highlands Mobile Home Park at least a half dozen times to discuss this design and this approach. And I think that's particularly noteworthy, that that collaboration has actually been ongoing for years, but it's been concentrated with this development as of late. The Planning and Zoning Commission, as I mentioned earlier, recommended approval. There were two notable conditions. The Pima County approved building height of 34 feet was with the offer by the applicant. The applicant offered to and agreed to a condition to lower that height to 24 feet and single story throughout the proposed subdivision. There was also a provision to include trails relative to, in compliance with our trails master plan, and those have been included in the plans before you attached to your council packet. What wasn't an explicit condition, but was embedded in the proposal, was a neighborhood ask by the folks in the Shorecliff area to have the connection to Shorecliff be exit only. And the applicant offered to include that as a concession to the neighbors, and it's within the proposal that's before you tonight. And some, all of the River's Edge PAD zoning standards have been satisfied. And, you know, as I perhaps over-punctuated the importance of use of county zoning and the design, the need for the design, requirement for the design to reflect previous Pima County proposals. The drainage basin design is a regional improvement. And it's a step toward solving existing issues as well as any drainage coming from the subdivision. Once again, the commission recommends approval, and that concludes staff presentation. And Mayor, as mentioned previously, the applicant is prepared with a presentation as well.
Okay, thank you. We'd like to invite the applicant to come forward.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of council. My name is Paul Oland, representing the property owner and Meritage Homes this evening. After that rather exhaustive staff report, I will just hit some of the highlights rather than repeating some of the statements that I was going to make. So on here, just side by side, is our existing approved plan and then our proposed plan. You can see they're extremely similar. They've been vetted for a number of months, I think over a year now, back and forth with staff and numerous submittals to make sure that they are compliant, that our proposed plan is compliant with all applicable zoning back from its original approval back in Pima County and then annexed in and ordinanced and preserved that way. As Mr. Vella mentioned, we offered a single-story home restriction. We also offered a public trail easement so that the town's trails master plan could be could have a connection that's important to it. I do want to point out, not that it's particularly important, but I believe a number of you went out there on a field trip to just visit the site and appreciate the elevation difference between where these homes will go and where the existing homes are on either side. Well, the road that you drove down, the dirt road, is the existing sewer road, which is approximately where our road is too. So if that's helpful at all, you were basically driving down the proposed road alignment when you were out there. As Mr. Vella mentioned, we have two gated access points on the Ranha. We're also going to be installing a left turn lane in into that Naranja gate. So a westbound left turn in, which will be very similar to the one that's just further east on Naranja Drive there. Next slide here. Hey, it's working. So this is a slide that I think everybody in the room has probably seen before. I showed this at Planning and Zoning Commission as well. But this is updated with the current design and everything in terms of the proposed elevations. So you can see the Push Ridge Vista homes on the right side there, which is east, existing homes on the west bank there. The main wash channel there that Mr. Kiesler was pointing to on his map occupies this area over here, which is also where the basin will go further south within the project. So you can see that the existing homes are 28 to 44 feet higher than the proposed homes in terms of the base elevation of those homes. And with the 24-foot single-story restriction that Meritage has offered, there will be zero impact to views from neighboring property owners. And there it is. And just for perspective, this is a two-scale version of the Arizona football field. So if you put this existing home here that is up in Pushridge Vista at the goal line, the closest home here is well past the 50-yard line, not to mention a number of feet below it. So we're talking about a significant distance horizontally as well as the vertical drop. Mr. Kiesler also already touched on this, but the question came up as in terms of the slope treatment along the backside, the east side of the lots. So it is a mix of cut and fill there in terms of where the lots are going to be. There will be no impact to the integrity of the slope, of course, but it will be treated with drainage improvements, armored drainage improvements. In one area, there will be retaining walls put there. And again, everything has to pass muster with geotechnical engineers as well as the drainage engineers. This is just a close-up of the proposed left turn lane on Naranja. I realize there's a lot of lines on this map here, but you can see here's of course our gate. So a new left turn lane will be put in for people approaching from the east. It'll end there. So the existing eastbound lane will just kind of swoop a little further to the south. And go like that. So it's, again, if anyone's familiar with Naranja, very similar to the design that's just to the east. So again, that's really all I have to say. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. Again, we were happy to offer those additional design restrictions with the trail easement, the egress only on Shorecliff, as well as the single story restriction. So, I should also mention that it's about 70% open space. So a lot of this land is going to get left open either within the basin or hillside or just regular wash land. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olin. We'll have the council have questions a little bit later. So I'd like to ask our town attorney to read a statement at this time, and then following the statement by our town attorney, then we'll go to the blue cards that I have for this particular agenda item. Mr. Rothschild.
I want to let the public know, the council's aware of the constraints that the council is, legal constraints that the council's under here tonight. Arizona law is explicit, both by statute and case law, that a plat or conceptual site plan, which is what we're looking at here tonight, must be approved if it reasonably conforms to legal requirements. And what's most important, I think, to understand here is this is not a rezoning where an applicant is asking the council to provide a different zoning. In that case, the council has broad discretion. Here, the applicant is using existing zoning, and this matter is on for a procedural step, or what's sometimes called a ministerial act, just to see that the site plan conforms with that zoning. If this is the case, the state law requires the council to approve the plat, and that's whether the council wishes it were better or different or not at all. A little more about the history, and I think that's been gone over pretty well, but just to be clear, when a town is created, it must adopt the zoning of the county, and you know, obviously here it was Pima County, and that was done. That's also true of annexation. So here the county, at the time of annexation, approved this plan area development for the property, and a condition of the annexation was the approval of the plan area development, and Oro Valley accepted it. This was back in 1994, I think. So the parcel is zoned by the county, CR2, and those conditions have been gone over tonight. And the PAD adopted requires that the Pima County standards will apply. And in this PAD, I believe, even if you were to apply a town standard, it would have to be consistent with the county PAD. That was the stipulation. So there's a line of cases, and two involving Oro Valley in the past, where the courts have, I'm going to be generous and say, been very unkind to towns who did not comply with an approval where it was required. And the principle's pretty simple. In this case, the property owner has vested rights, in other words, has certain rights by zoning, and those rights can't be compromised once they're established. So in this case, and I think you've heard, this has been through the Planning and Zoning Commission. They reviewed it, and they approved it with the additional conditions which the applicant has accepted. The matter's also been reviewed by in depth by Joe Andrews, who is the town's land use attorney and a very accomplished land use attorney, and he is opined that it complies. And by Mr. Vella, who you've heard from tonight, who really his job is to go through these things with a fine-tooth comb. Now, there are cases when Mr. Vella tells developers that you're not in compliance and the developers have to go back. There's occasions when the applicant and Mr. Vella can't agree, and there's a proceeding in all towns called a Board of Adjustment, and that can go from there to the Superior Court and totally avoid this body. So council here is free to ask questions and, to assure, but they're not free to substitute their judgment. Because they have an opinion, otherwise there needs to be more. In addition, the state legislature passed a few years back something called the Regulatory Bill of Rights, which is a statute that says a town can't apply a code that was not attached to the land or even a code that is subsequently adopted. So it is true that, since 1995, the town has adopted other codes and standards, but they can only be used here by agreement with the applicant. So I just, in fairness to the council, I just want folks to know what that constraint is. And with that, Mayor, I'll turn it back.
Thank you, Mr. Rothschild. So at this time, I have four blue cards. I'd like to invite each of you to come and speak to the council. If you'd please state your name and whether or not you're a resident of Oro Valley, and you have 3 minutes. Sue Renand?
Renault.
Okay.
Hi. I've only been living here for 3 years. I love Oro Valley very, very much. When I first came here, I just fell in love with the community. Please bear with me, I'm not used to speaking. When I saw this proposal, I was very angry. Then my anger turned to deep sadness because I love this community so much. I love the way it looks. I don't know what it's going to look like 10 years from now. I read an op-ed last week in the newspaper. Someone had written about complaining about Marana is developing too quickly, too fast, and too much. And after I read the op-ed, I said to myself, wow, I think this is happening to Oro Valley. I really do. I lived in California for quite a while, and I saw what overdevelopment looks like, house upon house upon house upon house. where I live on the outskirts in River's Edge, too. And I felt like I'm watching all over again what happened in California. I feel like Oro Valley is going to turn into another California. It's going to turn into Phoenix. I'm 74 years old. I was hoping to stay here till I was about 84. But if this development continues, I don't know what it's going to look like when I'm 84. I feel like I'm going to have to leave because there's going to be so much congestion, so much traffic. I feel like the beauty of Oro Valley is very, very slowly eroding. I was told that originally this development was supposed to be for something like 40 homes. Now it's gone to 64. To me, that's overdevelopment. And I think it's going to create a drain on our water system. We already have water shortages. It's going to create a drain on our electricity. And most of all, I can just see more and more smog developing because we're going to be surrounded by traffic. This is not the type of community that I want to live in. I love it now, but I also feel that all of the homes around this development, I think this is not going to help the prices of the home go up. I think our prices are going to diminish as a result. The more building there is, this is not going to help our homes. After hearing Mr. Rothschild speak, I'm not an attorney. I'm overwhelmed by everything they said. I know that I have no say-so, and I know that standing here tonight is not going to make one bit of difference, but I think the city council needs to look to the future and put the brakes on development, and I hope that you think about that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to invite Aldi Rose.
Hello, and thank you for letting me speak. I've studied this project extensively.
If you could state your name and whether you're a resident
of Oro Valley. Aldi Rose, resident of Oro Valley. I talked to the city planner today. I've been researching this project ever since the first signs came up. And obviously everybody's trying to work very hard to make it work. My main two concerns are this, that Oro Valley is going to be financially responsible for taking care of this basin and this wash issue. This is a private gated community. So if you open this door now to let one builder do this, let's see how many other builders want Oro Valley to participate in a drainage system. The cost projected at $1,200 a year for landscaping and $5,000 every 3 years, I have no idea how they pulled them out, but we don't know what's going to happen with land shifting. That is a big concern for me. Where is that money going to come from? Is it going to come from our taxes? Your idea that, yeah, we have better control if we control it, but this is a private gated community. This is not a public land. And the other concern I have, and I understand that this was all done in the 80s and 90s, but life has changed. The world has changed. And we in Oro Valley need to take heed to what we do here to protect our citizens' water, fire, wildlife, and each other. And those are my concerns.
Thank you. I'd like to invite Brenda Harris. If I could ask you not to applaud after someone has spoken. I realize we applauded during the proclamations. I mean, there's a time and a place. This isn't the time to applaud or make other gestures. Thank you.
Mayor Winfield, Vice Mayor Barrett. I'm Brenda Harris. I'm a resident of Oro Valley. Members of council, town staff, and officials, thank you for having me speak. My main concern here is that this is a high-density, maximum profitability developer with impacts to our environment, our wildlife in Highlands Wash. My concerns are many, but not limited to the aquifer that we all get our water from. I'd like to know if they're building with green consciousness. I've heard and listened to the engineer regarding floods and traffics, but I honestly think that what's happening is that we're going to increase traffic on Naranja so much that we have a new traffic light coming. There's no way around it. To turn into that development, you'll have to have some safety mechanisms put in place there. With regard to the public works staff benefit, he outlined three benefits, one of which was a sound barrier. I don't think the mobile home development is complaining at all about sound up from Naranja right now, so I think that's a fallacy. I don't think the sediment collection by the development is much needed either. And finally, I don't think the discharge sandbars that we have to remove periodically are unbearable. So those three benefits that this development provides are really not at all benefits. They're just rhetoric. I'm really concerned about the drainage basin, as my previous this previous speaker said, that now the town takes over the liability for this basin. What happens to the mobile home insurance premiums when this increases their flood? You know, it's already in a flood zone, but now you have a basin to house all that water. And he mentioned that if it was a two-year storm, what happens in a 100-year storm? Like, this thing is going to really flood. I don't know the statistical significance of his engineering research or the confidence intervals, but I'm clearly not convinced that this is good. I think this is maximum profitability, high-density living. And I don't understand the attorney, Mr. Rothschild, how it didn't pass before and how we're obligated to pass it now. So those are my concerns. My 2 minutes.
Thank you. I'd like to invite Mary, and I apologize, Ramba? Mary, are you with us?
Good evening. My name is Mary Rambo. I live at Shorecliff and Chapin Court. If there's 64 homes and there are going to be 500,000, that means at my house I'm going to have 124 cars leave every morning because all of them are going to have to work. I don't understand how we didn't approve 46 and why would we approve 64? It just boggles my mind. I'm worried about the water. Do we have enough? And I feel sorry for Naranja because they can say they've got a left turn, but that street is busy now. And again, 64, 128, it doesn't make sense. I saw you all come and go up to see the property, and it's a wash, and it will always be a wash. And that's just my opinion. Thank you.
So I have no other blue cards for this particular agenda item, and so I'm going to now allow the council to ask questions to staff and to the applicant. Councilmember Bowen?
I have a question. I'm not sure if it's for Beyer or Paul. Is this project viable without the retention basin?
Mayor, Councilmember Bowen, so far without the basin, all the other iterations were not viable because of the restriction due to the floodplain ordinance. It just mathematically didn't work on that look right here. This encroachment into the floodplain caused the water to raise, so it had been a problem. So the basin solved that problem. That's the best way I can answer this right now. without going into a crystal ball situation.
My concern is when I read the staff write-up, you know, we had proposed as the town to maintain the basin as an equity issue because we were providing infrastructure that helped downstream properties. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes, because the basin itself is oversized, and the oversizing of that basin helps the downstream property. That creates a regional benefit. When you essentially have more than a singular subdivision, more than just this private gated subdivision that is a beneficiary of the improvement, that's where it makes reason for the town to step in and to take control of it because, again, we don't want the lack of action by one subdivision to impact another subdivision. So part of being a public entity is we provide these services to the public, and I would argue that for any situation. We've mentioned it just to the east for the Catalina Ridge subdivision in that channel because that impacts three different subdivisions. It's kind of the same thing. If it was an improvement that only benefited that singular subdivision, then I would argue as your town engineer, no, that doesn't make sense for the town to take that burden on. But because it actually provides a positive benefit for other residents, then I'll make the argument then yes.
And regarding the physical access to the retention basin, is that through the new subdivision or is that through the mobile home park? How do you get into the retention basin to service it?
So right now, preliminarily, it's through the subdivision itself. So we'll have to have access through it. And there's breakpoints between the houses off a shore cliff that allow us to get in there. But that's a detail that will be worked out as we work out the details of the actual engineering, because we'll have to have the adequate access to get in there, the adequate access to dredge and pull out the sand and be able to ship that out.
But as it is designed right now,
it does.
Access would have to be provided to the town who doesn't live there.
It will need to, yes.
And we would only have it for service. We'd only have access there for servicing the retention basin.
Yeah, maintenance and management of it, yes.
That's my concern. When I read through the write-up, I heard this was a small HOA. Well, 64 homes to me isn't necessarily a small HOA. When I think of $5,000 a year, what is that per home? And that's like $4 a month per home for critical infrastructure. That right. To me, this isn't equity. This is an enabler of this entire subdivision. Mm-hmm. And I'm concerned. You might say, well, it's only $4,000. But coming from where? You know, I see the town and the developer at the table, but they're not spending either of theirs money. I don't think this money's coming from your or buyer's budget, is it? Where does this money come from that we used to allocate?
Mayor, Councilmember Bone, it will be coming out of my budget. It'll be coming out of the stormwater budget.
And if you weren't using it for this, what would you be using it for?
Well, other similar uses that we have throughout town. We dredge and we take care of public channels throughout town. So it's the same thing. It's the same action. It adds to it, but we have the capacity to be able to add this to it. But it's certainly within council's purview to accept it or not. My cautionary tale to the council is that as we've seen, and this is based upon experience, the channel in Catalina Ridge subdivision, had that been maintained from day one, it would not be in the shape it is today. But again, that was a small subdivision that did not maintain their channel. Now, there are consequences. We do have regulations. There are consequences. And we do monitor private drainage infrastructure. But again, for the benefit of the public, that's why you have my opinion, but you are the decision makers. My opinion is to make it a public maintenance, and that way we're assured that it will be maintained. It's certainly within council's purview to make it privately maintained, in which case we will chase after the subdivision if they don't keep up to the regular maintenance schedule.
Thank you. And then I think my next question would be for Mr. Vella.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
And it regards a phrase that we've been talking about the last couple of weeks that's a little bit irksome to me because it involves two words that, to me, don't go together at all. And it's okay. What we call substantially compliant. And to me, substantially is a very gray word, where compliant is very black and white. Mm-hmm. So in your words, when we use the term substantially compliant, can you put that into more concrete terms, maybe into a percentage? Or what do you, you know, when you see requirements, you know, what percentage of compliance represents substantial to you?
Council Member Bowen, I have to agree with you. I don't like that phrase either, substantial compliance. When it comes to zoning, clear zoning standards, setbacks, building heights that are measurable, 100% compliance is required, period. So the word substantial gets put in front of the word compliance when we're working with things such as our design standards and our design principles, which are created with a level of ambiguity. So there's judgment and gray area in there. So two people might look at the same design standard and come away with legitimately a different opinion. So that's where the word substantial comes into play. But when it comes into items relative to density, et cetera, where code's black and white, that word doesn't belong at all. So I hope that helps clarify.
So I had made a point to ask this question in advance. As of today, the conceptual site plan for this development, is it fully compliant to the Oral Valley Zoning Code, or is it only substantially compliant?
Let's let Beyer respond.
If I may, Mayor, Council Member Bowen. So I give you a complete answer. I want to better understand your question. Relative to the permissions in the code, relative to putting Pima County codes front and center, or should I, in terms of responding to your question, ignore that fact and take a deep dive into areas where Oro Valley Zoning Code, which isn't applicable, would not meet Oro Valley Code? Can you help me?
Sure, the latter. Are there any areas of these Oro Valley Zoning Code that this would not meet if it had to be approved under the Oro Valley Zoning Code?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be glad to answer.
Mr. Mayor, point of order.
And what's
that
the nature
question,
of
the... Our attorneys already said it has to comply with Pima County. That's an irrelevant question. Why are we going down something? I said, well, what about Marana's code? Am I not correct? Isn't that irrelevant, our town attorney?
I think Council Member Bowen is looking for some comparison between our code and the county's code. I think it's a legitimate question.
All right, if I may, Mayor. So there are roughly eight areas where the non-applicable Oro Valley Code substantially differs from Pima County's. So I'm going to go over those high level very quickly. So in not any particular order, maximum building height, lower in Oro Valley, minimum lot size, higher in Oro Valley, minimum lot width, greater in Oro Valley, setbacks, greater in Oro Valley. ESLO standards are stricter than Pima County cluster option standards. Grading, town standards are stricter than Pima County's standards. Recreation, our standards are higher for this particular development. This particular development in Pima County is not required for to provide a rec area. And landscaping, last item, the standards in Pima County versus Oro Valley are different. So, and there's a little bit of give and take there. I can't say one is stronger than the other. So, sure.
Thank you. Those are my questions.
Councilmember Green.
Paul, a question for you. I certainly understand the need for the retention pond to cut down the velocity of that water and help protect the mobile homes down below. How often is the sedation in there or the sediment going to need to be cleaned out? And a rough idea, I know you don't maybe have a pencil point on it, but how much will it be to do that and how often?
Sure. So we actually, it's part of the drainage study, and we looked at the sediment transport. It's all part of the engineering. Now, this is empirical engineering. Empirical engineering and what happens in Mother Nature can sometimes differ, but what we have to go off right now is the empirical engineering. The empirical engineering shows that we need to get in there about every 3 years to go ahead and to maintain that 10 acre feet. And that 10 acre feet is with sediment in. So there's already a cushion. The basin actually starts off a little bit larger. It will have sediment. And when it gets to a certain level, when it has about that 10 acre feet left, that's when we go and we dredge it out. We're estimating about every 3 years.
And the cost of that, roughly?
$5,000. And because it's us, now I can't say what that cost would be if it were a contractor with a private development. As Councilmember Bowen was asking, I don't know what that cost is. I know what it's going to cost the town in fuel, use of wear and tear on the machinery, and staff out labor hours. Okay.
Councilmember Solomon?
I want to just continue some of the questions on the wash. If I'm correct from the presentation you showed, that wash actually originates about 3 miles to the north, north of Moore Road, up in Rancho Vistoso?
Yes, sir. Could we get back to Town's presentation? Yes, it originates up in Rancho Vistoso.
So that accommodates drainage from a good number of homes upstream.
It does.
Is that correct?
It does. And, you know, in the natural, Mayor, Councilmember Solomon, in the natural, I'll call it operation, but for all intents and purposes, operation of a channel, of a natural drainage through the desert, it picks up sand, it drops out sand, it undulates through the terrain.
And from this diagram, we see the little blue box at the very bottom. It looks like this subdivision represents an extremely small percentage of the water that flows through this wash. This subdivision is contributing a teeny bit to that flow. Is that correct?
That is correct. That's why I made the statement that the basin is sized many times larger than this subdivision will create. And that's the whole pre-development, post-development. So, by law, they're supposed to be able to, they're supposed to manage the drainage that they create after they develop, which is a very, very small portion of what that basin actually holds.
Right. So the community needs to recognize this is a community wash. This is why you have a public works department. If you had every individual subdivision maintaining or not maintaining their little section of wash, it turns into a nightmare. This is what we had about 30 years ago when we approved subdivisions where the HOAs maintained their little segment of the wash and found out they didn't have the money or didn't really care about maintaining the wash, and it created problems upstream and downstream. So this is exactly the situation where you want the town to be handling this. This is not a gift to a small subdivision. This subdivision could say, hey, everybody upstream, you guys should be paying us to take care of all the sand that you're washing down into us. The other thing is, let's put costs in perspective. The town just took over ownership of the former Vistoso Golf Course. We're estimating $250,000 to $300,000 a year in maintenance for that property. And that's for open space. This is not something that's going to break the town's budget, and it's totally reasonable and actually something that the town should be doing. So I just wanted to address that issue. A few other issues. I know once people move here, they really don't like to see anyone else move here. But we do have to understand something. When you own a piece of property, you have property rights. The people who've owned this property may have owned it since the 80s. They bought the property with anticipation of eventually using the property. Here we are 40, 50 years later, and they want to use it. It's really not a fair argument to say, well, now that I'm here, I don't want anyone else driving on Naranja. Now that I'm here, I don't want anyone else using the water. Now that I'm here, I don't want people contributing to smog. You know, we all have that tendency. I understand it. But what we also need to realize is just like when you bought your piece of property, whether it was a year ago, 3 years ago, or 30 years ago, that property came with some rights. You had the right to have a home built on it. You had the right to have a swimming pool built on it. You had the right to use the public roads. And that also applies to this property. So I just ask residents, keep this in perspective. I've been here on council for a long time and involved in this community and development for about 30 years. 30 years ago, I heard the exact same arguments from people regarding subdivisions that were up for approval 30 years ago. If council had listened to all those arguments, I doubt anyone in this room would be here right now living in a home in Oro Valley. All right? Change happens, subdivisions happen, people come, and this is not uncontrolled. This is being built at less than half the density allowed. There's an enormous amount of open space. Yes, it's a difficult piece of property. The mobile home park, it's been there a long time, built in a floodplain. I don't know how it was approved to be built in a floodplain, what the circumstances were. It's a bad situation. If I were them, I'd be very concerned about the water flow coming down and what's going to happen to my home. This actually helps it. If this development wasn't built, their water flow would be the same it is today. This is actually going to help reduce it a teeny bit, but it still reduces it. It doesn't contribute to it. So all I'm getting at is this is an overall good development that does substantially comply with the regulations. Some people may have a different opinion, but with the zoning laws and the property rights and our design standards, this meets those. The developer didn't have to reduce the height. In fact, I'm almost surprised that they agreed to do that. 34-foot height gives you two-story homes. 24-foot height doesn't. They did that voluntarily. They're not interfering with anyone else's view. They're way down, as everyone's saying, in a wash, and people are on the ridgeline. So, yes. You know, I know people don't like to see new developments, but all of us live in homes that are built in developments. And the second component of this is, yes, if it complies, we have a legal obligation. Just like we cannot prohibit you from putting a pool in your backyard if you want a pool in your backyard, if it meets zoning codes. So I just wanted to make those comments and get those questions answered. Thank you.
Mr. Kiesler, what further measures are needed to protect Highlands Mobile Home Park? And in relation to the retention basin, was the design of the basin driven with that thought in mind of protecting Highlands Mobile Home Park as well as serving the stormwater requirements of this proposed subdivision?
So, Mayor, that was exactly why we negotiated this basin with the developer. The developer, by code, did not need to provide this size of a basin. They only needed to provide enough measure to be able to make the drainage work and be code compliant. They went oversized on the basin to help the mobile home park. And as I mentioned, in the 100-year flow, it reduced the flow by 3%, which is really not much. Most of the homes that are currently in the floodplain will remain in the floodplain. However, as I mentioned, as it takes the energy out of that flow, that 2,000 CFS that comes down through that, 2,000 cubic feet per second, it's a pretty good chunk of water. It comes down there at full force. It hits the mobile home park at full force. The mobile home park has a central channel. That channel is completely undersized, and that's why the water spreads out through a good portion of the mobile home park. The mobile home park ultimately needs to have that central channel improved. It needs to be deepened and widened narrowly between the existing homes that are there, but it's a major infrastructure project in order to completely pull them out of the floodplain. But again, what I'm mentioning here is that this is not the panacea. This is not the full answer. It's a part of the answer.
Yeah, it's part of the answer. Of course, the retention basin, there's the balance of cut and fill. There's significant fill that's required for this project. It's coming from this basin.
That's correct.
The development is not importing fill.
Right, that's right.
Could the basin have been designed any differently that would have served the downstream residences greater than 3%?
Not really, sir. You'd have to turn that whole wash into a basin, kind of stair-step basins, and it's only going to take a small chunk of that water out. The true answer for the mobile home park is to improve their central channel. That's what's going to go ahead and solve their floodplain issues. But again, floodplain is always, it's varying degrees.
But how's the water discharged from the basin?
So with the water will fill the basin up to a certain point. There's a natural low flow point at there's a berm or a dike on the north side of the mobile home park. That berm has a low point in the middle. This basin will discharge out at that low point. That low point goes directly into the mobile home park channel.
So that berm or that channel is hardened so that there's not going to be erosion issues?
So the discharge, yes, sir. The discharge point needs to be hardened, and it will be.
I'm going to maybe change to, or I have a question about Naranja Road. So in the long term, Mr. Kiesler, 10 mm-hmm. years from now, it's envisioned that Naranja Road, what is the future cross-section?
Sure. Mayor, that's a great question. So the future cross-section, as I've mentioned many times here, for any of our two-lane roads, at least under my tenure here, I want to get our two-lane roads to be at least a minimum of three-lane roads, and that's to provide a center turn lane. This development, fortunately, it's required, so we can hold their feet to the fire on that, and we can force the third lane to be put in. And it's actually an extension from the turn lane that's just to the east.
And this is just, I haven't, just looking at it from your presentation, mm-hmm. The entrance off of Naranja, the circle, the called roundabout. It's not a roundabout, but you understand what I mean.
Turnaround circle.
Turnaround, thank you.
Yeah.
There's one to the east, and then there's another one to the east. There's two turnarounds. They look like they're pulled back further from Naranja.
They are. So by code, those have to be installed between the right-of-way line and their front gate. So it can't be installed in the right-of-way. You have to be able to turn around outside of the right-of-way because, say you, by mistake, you show up there, you're not supposed to be there, you can't get through the gate, you need to be able to amply turn around and be able to get safely back out in Naranja, and that's the purpose of that.
And the turnarounds are placed giving consideration to what will be that ultimate cross-section of Naranja?
In this case, yes. So if we could get the applicant's presentation up. He had a good exhibit of this. Oh, all right.
Slide 15,
can I actually, let's go to slide 15 of the town presentation. Sorry about that. Can we get slide 15? You were just past it. Keep going. Farther forward. One more. No, keep going. More. Almost there. All right, we'll go to the applicant. Stop. One slide back. Thank you. All right, so that turnaround, again, the right-of-way line is right there. So in answer to your question, Mayor, I know is the cross-section going to change? No, actually right there it's going to be at the ultimate cross-section because the turn lane will be in. The only thing that could affect that would be the addition of a multi-use path on the south side, which we may or may not be a part of that project again in the future, but there's room for it if it's needed within the right-of-way.
I mean, that's a good segue, actually. One of our residents wrote a letter in regards to this project. They live to the east, like many individuals you see riding bikes on the Ranha. It's not ideal, but pedestrians, runners, so on and so forth.
Right.
With this proposed cross-section, it constricts the pedestrian access?
No, they'll need to still provide that same shoulder at a minimum. So that, Mr. Mayor, that so what you have today, the amenity that you have today, you'll have in the future. The thing that we're looking for beyond that, again, if this project becomes a reality in the future for creating the three-lane section from La Cañada all the way over to First Avenue, is the addition of sidewalk on one side, multi-use path on the other side, that is separate from the actual paved section of the street.
So, Mr. Kiesler, the sections of Highlands Wash to the north that the town is responsible for the maintenance of the wash, are we meeting our obligations?
Boy,
in other words, are we maintaining it?
Yes. I'd be in trouble if I said no. No, we are. And honestly, sorry if I made light of that, but honestly, well, again, second wet monsoon season, no issues, because we have a very active stormwater utility, and they're doing their job.
I'm going to, as long as I have you here, I have a few more questions.
Sure.
You may or may not. On the conceptual plan, it shows, you know, the limits of grading, and then in the planting plan, it shows those areas being replanted. But my question is the limits of grading, will that be the limits of disturbance? In other words, will there be activity beyond those, you know, the toe of fill slopes?
Mr. Mayor, that really will be a zoning function. Once we have the actual limits established, a physical barrier is put up, so they're not supposed to cross that barrier.
And because there's some significant vegetation beyond,
yes,
specialty to the north, and as much as possible to protect that existing vegetation would be ideal.
And that's the normal course of construction, is to actually put, it's called an NOS fence, and that fence is to demark where you can't go beyond. Mm-hmm. And if you do go beyond, well, then we have zoning inspectors who do actually go out and...
It would be revegetated, presumably.
Yes. But and depending on what you do, and Mr. Bella could probably answer more coherently than I.
You did a good job.
You have to replace the plants, and sometimes even more than what you deserve.
So in the plans, it says that the landscape plants will, you know, essentially you can turn off the irrigation, which somebody was, you know, interested in. Water, as we all are. I mean, we're all concerned about that. So I think it's an important feature that should, you know, that I would want the public to be aware of. Mm-hmm. But in the planting list, it doesn't list, it lists a few plants, but then it just has generic symbols. The presumption is that the plant selection is going to mirror the Sonoran Desert. So in fact, they will be able to survive once the irrigation is turned off.
Yes, I mean, xeriscaping is part of our requirements, but I'm going to have to refer that to Mr. Vella because of the county nuance. I think the county has kind of the same rules, but Mr. Spade.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, to answer your question, yes, they will be required to use native Sonoran Desert vegetation. That's a requirement in the PAD, so yes, they will.
Okay, thank you. And then going back to the green consciousness, so this is maybe a little bit, it's not entirely off topic here, but maybe for Mr. Oland, the homes that are going to be built in terms of green consciousness, I mean, I think it's known that the newer housing, some of the features, amenity of those housing, there's water conservation features, and I'm curious, because of electric vehicles, what will these homes be? Will they have outlets that if somebody has a Tesla or whatever it is that they choose to drive, that they'll be able to plug in their car in their garage?
I wish I could phone a friend, Mr. Mayor. I don't know the answer, but okay. I can figure that out and get back to you in a few minutes.
I think that would be, sure. I mean, the upfront cost is so much less than having to add that later and just looking to the future. You know, 10 years from now, 30%, 40% of the cars on the road are going to be electric. It would seem to make a lot of sense. I'd also like to strongly encourage, you know, our developers to be thinking about using gray water systems or incorporating gray water systems as part of a home, again, part of that water conservation. So we'll leave that topic, but okay.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Mr. Kiesler, the basin, it shows the, I believe there's one access point to maintain the basin, right, for vehicles, equipment to get in there to dredge the sediment and so on and so forth.
So Mr. Mayor, that's what's shown conceptually right now. Uh-huh. Again, as we get through the detailed engineering, I'd like to see more.
Okay. Well, that was partly my question because there's it shows a road and mm-hmm. there's a road and then it also incorporates the public trail.
Right.
So I think it's important for folks to understand, too, that all of this open space will be open to the public. The trail will be open to the public. And even though it's a gated community, there will be public access. The road that's shown, though, the entrance into the reservoir is, it looks like it's located where there's a separation between a couple of houses. Mm-hmm. Just looking at it, it would seem to me that the easiest access point would be there to access and that you didn't need this longer section of road that would have to be maintained. Presumably it's going to be our responsibility. Since
Do we have, Mr. Olin, do you have a section of that here? Yeah, could you pull that up? So again, Mr. Mayor, at this level, we're looking at the concept to make sure that we can do it.
The one that shows it the best is actually the planting plan, because this has, I don't know if you have the planting conceptual plan.
Just have the CSP in my slides.
Oh, okay. So. All right.
Right. Yeah, it's right there. Yeah. But there's other, Mr. Mayor, as you've noticed, there's other gaps between homes as well. And again, what we want to do is we want to look at the width of those. And again, as we get into the detailed engineering and get this completely developed, then we'll understand if there's other opportunities. Having one way in and out of the basin means that if that gets choked off, then we got to rebuild it just to get in. So I'd rather have some type of redundancy there. But again, that's something that we'll work out in that detailed design.
Okay. How will the one of our residents was concerned about water ponding in the retention basin and mm-hmm. Mosquitoes and so forth. So could you speak to that?
Sure. So, Mr. Mayor, we have a 12-hour basin draining requirement, and that's per our code. That's per our ordinance. And if right now the percolation is showing that it will indeed drain in that time, but if with time it silts up or it becomes longer, there's ways for us to manage that. And that is that we can install other drainage measures. We can put in some types of French drain in there to keep that infiltration going. Because, again, it helps our aquifer as well to go ahead and put that water back into the Oro Valley aquifer. We can scarify. We can rip that bottom apart. Then the other thing is if we have standing water, the immediate concern, well, we have what's called dunks. So what we do is we foul the water that doesn't allow the mosquitoes to breed. And we routinely do that throughout town. There's areas all over town where we have to, both public and private, in order to maintain the health of the community, we throw these fouling dunkets into that holding water.
Okay, thank you. And I forgot to check the time when I started asking questions, and I feel like I'm monopolizing, so I've got a few more, but I want to counsel other questions.
You've already asked some of mine, so I'm just
okay. keep rolling. I've got a few more. Let's see, discharge. So, Mr. Olin, how did we get from 46 homes to 64 homes? Just going back to the neighborhood meetings when this was originally being proposed.
Sure, Mr. Mayor. As I mentioned, we've been working on this project for a long time. well over a year. And our original proposal, I believe, didn't even connect the two roads. We had a cul-de-sac coming in from either side. So there was just, in that concept, there was less road frontage to provide lot access. Along the way, I think as a result of some refined drainage design, more talks with the fire department about acceptable dual access, we decided, well, we'll bring the road all the way through, put gates on, and that created more frontage. So, and we looked at the zoning, and of course, we're well under that. So we mm-hmm. thought, okay, we can preserve the design intent, and again, we think make a better design.
Okay, thank you. In the maybe this is for Mr. Vela. In the proposed conceptual landscape plan, it lists really some significant numbers of trees, shrubs, and so forth. Well, are those with the approval of this? Are those there's 12 almost 1,300 shrubs, 1,700 small shrubs. It looks 499, almost 600 trees. Okay, does that, with this approval, those numbers are good numbers? We're not going to see less.
Mr. Mayor, yes, correct. Those are the numbers that we will hold them to. And the reason we don't have specific plant species at this point is it's still early in the process as part of that conceptual site plan, right? So as we develop the final site plan, should this move forward, then we'll identify what those individual plant species are and where they go with the kind of shrub and tree symbols that are shown on there today. But yes, we would hold them to it.
Okay, so Mr. Spaeth, we'll just stay on the planting. I mean, things what's being proposed is richly planted in the graded areas and common areas and so forth, until you get to the east end. So the ingress, or is it egress? You can't exit.
Down on Shorecliff egress?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then it's a barren landscape. I don't think there's a plant in the planting plan.
Right. Mr. Mayor. So there? If actually we're on the correct exhibit here, I realize this isn't the landscape plan, but on the site plan here, you can see that there's obviously a lot of topography and hillside that's going on there. So all of that is going to remain untouched. Within the limits of grading that are shown on this plan, there's a lot of rock riprap and other structures being built to maintain the integrity of where the road is going to be extended. So there isn't actually a lot of space in that area to add landscaping, again, under the acknowledgement that a lot of the natural desert in those areas are going to be preserved.
That's certainly true, although it looks like there's some significant fill, cut. I understand that cut is probably going to be either riprap or grout, or not grout, gunite. But if there's any way to soften that end with some vegetation, I think that would certainly improve the plan.
Certainly. Happy to work with the applicant on that.
Yeah. Councilor Vice Mayor Barrett?
Which end? I'm sorry.
So it's the east end. It's the east end. It's the Shorecliff.
Okay.
I guess it's all Shorecliff, but going towards Lambert. The Lambert end.
Okay.
Justin, would you mind pulling up attachment 2 on my staff report? Can you do that?
Shows the landscape plan a little better context. But right down at the southeast corner, where you're connecting to Shorecliff. Sorry, it's not actually in the presentation. It would be on my staff report. I don't even know if that's possible.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Vice Mayor has a follow-up.
Okay.
I have a follow-up question while you're pulling that up. One of my big concerns for this development is obviously the environmental destruction of the wash, as well as the visual impact of that large drainage basin. And so along the same lines of the plantings, is there any way that we can soften or fix through planting trees, et cetera, the visual appearance of the drainage basin? and potentially make that a condition of the town taking on the drainage basin?
Mr. Mayor, Vice Mayor Barrett, so the applicant's conceptual landscape plan, as we'll pull it up here in just a second, number two there, does include enhanced plantings around the basin to help obstruct the visibility of that larger sand deposit area, right, that folks from the mobile home park will be able to see, and then, of course, folks up on the ridge and Push Ridge Vistas 1 and 2. So that is there today, but if you feel like there's more that could be included, I guess defer that to Mr. Olin to see if that was something he was comfortable with or...
Okay, I guess I don't have a really good picture in my mind of what it will look like.
Sure.
Given the plants that are already required today. But in my conversations and the site plans and things, it seemed to me that it was going to be a large sand basin. So anything that we can do to sure. assist with the visual appearance of that, I think would be beneficial.
Sure.
Mayor, Vice Mayor, we'll have to weigh that against our ability to maintain it. So if you planted a thick grove of trees in there, we'll obviously not be able to go in there and dredge it. Now, certainly allowing all the low level and, you know, medium sized brush to reestablish in it, that's perfectly fine. But I think we want to, again, we want to gauge maybe a tree here or there is something that we could work with, and that's something we could work through the landscape plan with the developer on. But we need to keep it as clear as possible in order for us to actually be able to maintain it and dredge it. And that would be whether it's us or the actual subdivision itself. I do want to add one thing, though. There was a question earlier, and I did not answer that well, if I could just interject this quickly. And that is where this money coming from for us dredging this? And just doing a quick calculation, 64 homes annually will contribute towards their stormwater fee. You know, every home pays $450 a month in stormwater. So if you added that all up, that's just under $3,500 per year. So if you collected all of that together, again, that's going to pretty much balance out the additional cost that the town would bear under the ordinary circumstances. I'm not talking about major repairs, but under ordinary circumstances. I just want to get that out there.
Thank you. Are there additional questions? I've exhausted my questions. Okay, Vice Mayor Barrett.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about, I have a couple questions about Naranja. I just want to clarify, I asked Mr. Kiesler this, but I just want to, on the record, about the road widening being to the south so that we maintain the opportunity for a multi-use path to the north. Can you just address
yes.
that one more time?
Yes.
The road widening will be to the
you
south.
You are correct.
Okay, great. Thank you. And then, let's see. Oh, the issue of the traffic light that was brought up by one of our constituents. I'm aware that right now the development doesn't need a traffic light, but we are expanding Naranja Park mm-hmm. just down the way,
right.
which will probably generate additional traffic on Naranja. So what is in the future with additional traffic from the mm-hmm. park and things? Would there ever be a point at which this development would then need a traffic light?
That one I can look into my crystal ball. This development, no. Other developments, maybe. It depends on the expansion and the change in traffic patterns. Certainly Montero Hills or Montero Vista, that may be in the future, depending on how congested Naranja gets. The park itself, we actually did a traffic warrant study for the park itself, and we're finding that not now. And not in the near future. And that's because the main entrance, of course, is going to be up off of Tangerine. But that was one of my concerns that we did look at, and we did do the study for that. I think the possibility of seeing a light out there is minimal to nil throughout at least the foreseeable future. But at this subdivision, at this entrance, I can guarantee you absolutely not. It's not big enough. It would never be warrant.
Okay, thank you. And then I have a question for the applicant about the height limitation. If the height limitation were 28 feet, could you build two-story homes? Currently, you have 24 feet as the offered height limitation. If it, there was a slide that said 34 to 28 feet for two stories. So if the height limitation were 28 feet, could you build two-story homes?
I feel like I'm going to repeat my former movement here, and I'm not getting any help.
Yeah.
We did, but it...
I'm just asking a theoretical question.
Yeah, you could do a two-story under at a 28-foot height.
Okay.
There you have it.
A little bit under.
Okay, thank you.
There's not much
what
difference.
I'd like to kind of ask about and throw out to the council and maybe hear from the staff about the neighbors. I attended a lot of the neighborhood meetings and I didn't and the planning and zoning meeting, and I didn't hear a lot of concerns about the height specifically, and it seemed like it was something that kind of got thrown in the last minute at the planning and zoning. When I did the site tour, I felt like the site was very far down visually, and personally I would like to raise the height limit to 28 feet or consider that so that the applicant could build two-story homes and if they needed to. And my reasoning for that is just that that allows more diversity of housing options, as well as it's easier for families to find enough bedrooms for children and things like that in a two-story, or to have a little more yard space available in a two-story home. So that was just kind of a thought that I had in, you know, this being a development that we know will go in, and it's near a park with playgrounds and children amenities. So, I mean, it's not something I'd want to pursue if the feeling was that the neighbors strongly had felt that it needed to be one story. But if that wasn't a strong requirement, then I personally would be in favor of having that greater diversity. I guess that's a question for Mr. Vella in terms of what you kind of heard as the planning staff. I know I attended a lot of the meetings, but I'll ask you.
Yes. I think, if it may, Mayor, Vice Mayor, you know, I think in the early neighborhood meetings, there was an initial concern about the building heights. My sense was that dissipated as the discussions and the graphics were depicted. So that was not an issue that was brought up strongly, or I don't recall it being actually brought up at the commission meeting by the neighbors. It was something that was led by the commission in terms of the discussion. That changed it from 24 to 28. Staff would be fully supportive of. I think your observation is right on point. Those houses could be well above 28 feet and still have no impact whatsoever on the neighbors because they're on the ridgeline. So I think that is a functional fact. So that change is certainly supported by staff.
Thanks. I mean, for me, we're talking about a 4-foot difference that then would allow potentially larger homes or, you know, bedrooms upstairs, easier for families to get in, easier for families to be able to have a yard, and there would be a mix. So I don't know. It's just a thought that I had when I was on the site tour. So,
other questions? Councilmember Solomon?
I'll just concur with the Vice Mayor. It would give the flexibility to the property owner in the design of homes with the choice of one or two story options. And there are obviously advantages going vertical, leaves more room for the yard. And Oro Valley does have codes in place that they would need to follow regarding the number of two story homes in a row. Two-story homes on corners and so forth. And once again, they're entitled to, is it 34 feet? So we're still looking at a reduced height. So I'd be supportive of that.
Other questions? I support that as well.
Mr. Mayor.
Vice Mayor Barrett.
Can I ask if we were to raise the height to 24 feet, could the applicant then agree to follow the Oro Valley code in terms of where the two stories are located? No, because the Oro Valley code.
We could put that in. Yeah. Because the owner today may not be the owner tomorrow.
Right. Yeah, so we would have to put that in. I mean, I'm all about protecting views. I just feel like this would give a little flexibility without hurting views. Okay. I make a motion to approve the... I don't have it in front of me. Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I move to approve the proposed conceptual site plan and landscape plan based on finding it is in conformance with the River's Edge planned area development. Don't we have conditions? There were two conditions. Sorry, give me one second.
What are the conditions?
If I may, Mayor, Vice Mayor, the two conditions adopted by the commission have been embedded in the current proposal, so you don't have to re-specify them.
Oh, okay, so I just have to make my one amendment.
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
Thank you for clarifying, sorry.
I would second that.
Okay, wait, let me say it one more time. I move to approve the proposed conceptual site plan and landscape plan based on a finding it is in conformance with the River's Edge planned area development, and raise the height limit to 28 feet, subject to two stories being placed according to the Oro Valley Zoning Code.
Mr. Olin, Ms. Sylvan, are you agreeable to that additional commitment?
Yes, sir, we are.
Okay.
Agreeable. Thank you.
Okay, it was seconded by Councilmember Green. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed, nay. The ayes have it, 7-0. Thank you, staff and applicants and members of the community that have spoken tonight. Yes?
Am I allowed to ask Mr. Solomon a question?
No, not really. But yeah, but you know what? We're going to take a 10-minute break. And if you'd like to speak to him during that 10-minute break and he would like to speak to you, then that's certainly an option. Okay, we're going to resume our regular session this evening. So if you'd like to close those conversations so that we can move on this evening. Or you have the option of taking your conversation outside. We're going to have Mr. Standish read item number 4.
Discussion and possible direction to staff regarding possible vacation and short-term rental regulations.
Thank you. This item was requested by Councilmember Solomon and Mayor Winfield, and I'll turn the floor over to Councilmember Solomon.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I know we've all gotten a lot of feedback from residents and HOAs with their frustration about some short-term rentals or Airbnbs popping up in their neighborhoods, and those are regulated by state law, which my understanding is, of course, overrides even CCNRs. However, as we're aware, the state law, the state legislature just expanded some rights that municipalities have on regulations of these units, and I think it would be wise for us to ask staff to come back with some potential ordinance regarding this. I would have two comments on that. One is that if we do ask staff to do this, that they seek input from the Tucson Association of Realtors, which would be the main group regarding single-family homes and how they're used, and also from our local homeowners associations. So that was really the extent of my comments on this, was to for council to consider and ask staff to bring back some potential proposals regarding this matter.
Councilmember Green?
It was interesting at the Convention of Towns and Cities that two of the mayors spoke, one from Sedona, where they have 30% short-term rentals, and Scottsdale, where they've gone up to about 26%. And some of the issues that are in our report are excellent. But the one thing that came from both of them that isn't in the statute, and that is the health care issues, that they have people with health care problems and they have no idea about them. When the EMTs arrive and they've had atrial fibrillation or they've been, and so if our fire department could add that to the regulations, that would be very helpful for them if they have to arrive for an emergency kind of thing. Anyway, for what it's worth.
Vice Mayor Barrett.
Thanks. I think most of us attended that session. Thanks, Councilmember Green, for bringing it up. So my sense that I got from that and from other items that I've listened to, it was just on Arizona Public Media, a bit on short-term rental regulation, is that this area is still in flux because the legislature just came out with this this new opportunity for cities and towns to regulate short-term rentals. And so I agree that we should move forward with asking staff to bring back some options for council. However, I think there's some questions we need answers to, such as how many short-term rentals we have in Oro Valley, different types and options of regulation on them. One thing, what the staff report represents feels like a really lower level type of regulation where we would just require them to be licensed and then basically go from there in terms of health, safety, and welfare. But, you know, places like Paradise Valley have really codified what that health, safety, and welfare looks like and what those requirements are to enable enforcement of that. And I know that I believe that our police are in favor of having authority given to them by code to be able to enforce when they feel that they need to. So I would like to ask that any statute that's brought back that we have maybe multiple options. There will be a statute that the league is proposing as sort of a model ordinance. And then I think we need to look at what would it be for us to have a stronger level statute more similar to Paradise Valley's, where they've had that vetted under the previous legislation and it stood up to the Attorney General and things like that. And so I want to be able to look at a couple of those options. And then, yeah, so that's my thought.
Councilmember Jones-Ivey.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm definitely in agreement with having staff take a look at that. When I think about the number of families that are not here during certain times of the month, and those properties, if they're not, could possibly become vacation and short-term rentals. And I would like to see us get a jump on this before it becomes an issue like it did in some of the municipalities that shared information with us.
Any additional? Vice Mayor Barrett?
I will say that I think we can ask all of the public to weigh in on it and distribute it widely as we move forward, but I don't think it's necessary to have like realtors or HOAs have a specific seat at the table. I think we can have something developed and then have interested parties weigh in on that and provide their input the same as we typically do. Although I'm not opposed to offer, you know, distributing it to them in terms of saying here's an outreach, but that's different than something more specific than that.
Councilmember Solomon.
Well, I agree. We want all the input. It's just that we know we've already had several HOAs contacting the town regarding this, and it's a good group to specifically reach out to. Also, the Tucson Association of Realtors are really the local experts in single-family homes and real estate, and, you know, they have hopefully have knowledge in this area. So just, once again, it's an obvious group to at least make contact with, bring them to the table. Hopefully they can contribute. You know, there's a lot of pros and cons to this situation. And I think this is really, it's a very interesting situation because as we've seen more and more properties going this route. And I think it does affect the nature of a single family home neighborhood where now you have a rental. I know in HOAs like the one I'm in, we get into issues with pool regulations, trash regulations. Trash is only picked up one day a week by one company. And are these, do these people know about it? Or once again, issues with not following the rules and regulations of HOAs. So yeah, it is definitely a developing issue, and I'm kind of perplexed by how the state passed laws saying, you know, 30-day minimum rentals were no longer enforceable. So we definitely need to look at it. And it's going to be, unfortunately, not something done in a week or two because of all the issues and what's going on. Even though we have an incredible genius sitting right there, her name is Joe Andrews, for our legal advice.
Councilmember Green.
I have a copy of Scottsdale's regulations, if staff would like to have that, and also a contact person in Sedona that you could talk to, because they're really being turned upside down.
Yeah, Paradise Valley, Scottsdale, Sedona would be good communities to look at their ordinances. What I'm hearing, Ms. Jacobs, is certainly strong support from council about our interest in, you know, regulating vacation short-term rentals. We appreciate the town council report that was provided. Based on that, we understand that you're currently, you know, looking at what inventory we have or determining the number of vacation short-term rentals in the town, and also working with the League of Arizona Cities. And so based on the comments you've heard, I believe there's sufficient direction to...
Mr. Mayor, members of council, just to reiterate, I think what I'm hearing from council is that you are looking for the maximum legally supportable regulation that we can implement in this community, and that's exactly the kind of direction that we were looking for this evening. So one of the things that you will probably see on our website later this week is a notice of potential fees for short-term rental licensing, because by state law we must give a 60-day notice for that, so we can't even bring anything back to you that would go into effect until after that 60 days. So that'll give us an opportunity. Our staff, you may know that Joe Andrews served on a statewide committee of attorneys to develop the model ordinance. He's very familiar, has copies of all of these different ordinances, right, and will be advising the council. But our goal will be to bring back to you what we feel is the maximum supportable restrictions that we can put into place. And then, of course, as Councilmember Solomon mentioned, once we have something to kind of chew on, then we can certainly reach out to stakeholders for input. But as you know, when there's an ordinance, there's a process for that. Yeah. There's a public hearing. We have to post it. There certainly will be opportunity for that kind of input. But thank you for your candor. Glad you all got educated last week at the league so that Paul didn't have to do a spiel this evening, and that'll make it quicker for you to go into your next item. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Okay, thank you. So we will go to item number 5, Mr. Standish.
Discussion regarding the process by which public art is selected and executed.
This item was requested by Councilmember Green and Councilmember Solomon. I'll turn the floor over to Councilmember Green.
The issue of art is definitely in the eye of the beholder. And I think that's where a lot of the discord is coming from. I got probably more communications regarding the tangerine artwork than I've gotten on anything else. And I think that some of that could have been ameliorated by more wide involvement of the public. Now, there are not a lot of people out there that actually look at that unless they're driving by. The artwork at the entrance to the community center is viewed 24 hours a day, every day, by the people that live there. And they like the artwork. What they don't like is the back of the artwork. And Chris Cornelison put some landscapers to work, and the area that really was offensive to the people was decorated with some bushes and shrubbery and so forth that made it happy and made them happy. But I think we as a council need to know more about these public art projects, and we need to give more people a chance to weigh in on it. Certainly the ones who have to look at it every day, every night, need to have a voice in it. That's not a veto voice, but they need to have a voice in what is going to be happening. And so I think if we could maybe have a review of the process to educate us and see if there are places where we can make it more transparent for the public, or do we need to do more advertising? That's kind of where I'm coming from.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Councilmember Solomon?
Yeah, my wife and I are in disagreement on that new mural. I actually thought, wow, color in Oro Valley, this looks great. And people were complaining about it when they had first started, long before they were done. She still doesn't like it. I guess I'm one of the few people who actually does. But I think, right, the issue is, as Mo had brought up, is transparency. But I'm concerned that ultimately it's going to get down to in the eye of the beholder. But perhaps at least if there's more opportunity for public input, I'm not sure how that would work. Like I said, once again, now we're going to, I want to avoid where, and this happened on the public arts works that we required, where people would stand, get up at the approval, at the meetings, the hearings, and would, some would go, that's the most horrible thing I ever saw, and the artist was standing there trying to defend it, and other people would say, oh no, I think that's wonderful. So I'd like to avoid that. At the same time, try to see a little more transparency, or at least a little more exposure before it is finalized.
The other big issue for me is this is developed for the encouragement of art by young people, which is a really, really key thing. Most artists, if you talk to them, had someone early in their career that gave them that kind of encouragement that they could do it and that they could withstand criticism. So I think we're entering an area that we need to be very careful with so we don't turn off the kids who are in the Tabby Project. But how do we involve more public and yet not destroy the project that we're trying to run?
Vice Mayor Barrett and then Councilmember Jones-Ivy. Councilmember Jones-Ivy and then,
yes.
Vice Mayor Barrett.
Do we have someone here this evening to speak to the process?
Mr. Mayor and Councilmember Jones-Ivy, certainly Paul Kiesler and his department oversee the process. I think that, you know, we have already started looking at what we could do next time while still keeping the integrity of the Tabby process, which is what Councilmember Green mentioned. This really is a youth-driven process, but what we're looking at, and again, you won't see another Tabby project for 3 more years, so we've got enough time to put some thought into this and figure out what is the right way. But we've talked about doing the exploration phase first, because the issue is that it's a very short window with which the students are selected. They do their work, they select an art project, and then it has to move forward in order to get it done in the summertime. But perhaps what we can do, since, as you all mentioned, art is in the eye of the beholder, is at least identify concerns that then can be shared with the students as they develop the art. so that they can be more mindful of any potential concerns if it happens to be adjacent to a particular neighborhood, or, you know, we would identify the location a little bit earlier in advance and then figure out how we could get some input from some of those area residents to help set those parameters and then have the youth work within those parameters. So I think all those suggestions are great, and we are certainly plan to strive to do better for our next round of the TABI grant.
So Paul's going to be presenting to us this evening on the process as it stands now.
If there's specific questions that you'd
I
like
do
to
have
then
because
certainly
I absolutely don't even understand how this process came about, how it's working currently, and how do we get to, you know, be able to input into it?
Certainly, Mayor. Councilmember Jones-Ivy, I think that Ms. Jacobs really outlined, you know, we're going to look into the process itself, but just to give you back up and give you a little bit of a history, the process that we utilize for the TABI is actually very similar to the process that's in our zoning code. So we have a public art process in the zoning code. Then there's really kind of two paths that you can take in the zoning code. Path number one is that for private development, they're, you know, the whole 1% art that they're required to do as far as public art, they can opt to, one, hire a third-party reputable management company, such as SACA. And under the zoning code, the requirement for that is that SACA manages the project, they come up with the art piece, and that goes through the planning and zoning administrator for the planning and zoning administrator's final approval. It doesn't go to council, it just goes to the planning and zoning administrator to make sure that, you know, site visibility triangles, all those inherent development issues that we usually look at in any project are also taken care of in the art piece, but we leave the art to the art experts, which is like SACA. So it has to be an approved third-party management company. The second tract, of course, is to not hire someone like SACA and go ahead, and then that would go through staff review and then through the town council. Now, I don't think any of you have ever seen one come through you because everyone obviously opts for the first path. I'm sorry?
Church of the Nazarene.
Oh, did they? Okay. The TABI project, the town acts much like a developer. We hire SACA. We hire the art expert to go ahead and manage the project. We become the conduit for the money from PAG to the town. We pay SACA. SACA hires the artist. They hire the, they put out for the students. They do all of that administrative function and then work on the actual, with the artist on the art piece itself. The town, what our input is generally the location. So what we do is on the staff level, we look for precedent and we look for the importance of where it's going to go. For example, I'll use this piece in particular. We chose to put this piece outside of what's going to be the main entrance of Naranja Park because the precedent that's been set is we have another very nice art piece, again, in the eye of the beholder, of course, at the other entrance of the park. We put other art pieces throughout town at areas where we have a substantial improvement. We have one at the roundabout on Hardy and Northern. There's an art piece there. There's an art piece off of Palisades and First. Right when we got done widening First, we put one on Palisades and First. So we always look for that coherent tie-in to a major town amenity. And that's kind of the precedent that's set. And then the other similarity to what the zoning code is then SACA and the artists, they work with the students. SACA actually reached out to 700 residents in the town of Oro Valley with a survey. And that was, you know, what does Oro Valley mean to you? What are some intrinsic values of Oro Valley? They had a survey. Of the 700 people, I think it was 36 or 39 people actually responded to that survey, but they did get some input. And I think, as Ms. Jacobs mentioned, we can look at the survey. We can look at maybe making things a little bit better on that communication. I mean, we were looking for all the positive aspects, but maybe you want to put in there a question with regard to what concerns you about the RP. So something like that. We have time to work that out, and I think that's something that it's valuable information for us to be able to give to the students.
Paul, how were these 700 people selected?
SACA has a database of Oro Valley residents that are part of their art network. So that's how they reached out. Okay. Now, the other similarity to the zoning code is that once they create, you know, art pieces, they actually create a bunch of them. Then there's a committee of staff. We go to SACA, and they present their art pieces, and we come up with what we think is the one that we feel is most appropriate for the town. Now, that would end the similarity between the zoning code, because at that point, really, we're acting kind of like the planning and the zoning administrator. We're accepting it. But we take one final step, and that's we present it to you. We don't present it to you as a vote, but certainly if council had an issue with it, we'd have to scramble and go back to the drawing board. And we have scrambled in the past to go back to the drawing board to make sure that the art piece was appropriate. That's how we ended up with the quail out at the entrance of the park at Naranja. So, again, what I'm saying is we have a lot of similarities to what the zoning code is, but we can work on that. We have time to work on that, to get more inclusivity, maybe neighboring neighborhoods. We certainly don't want to, and again, you're getting my opinion, you don't want to have the students paint by number. There's a process. SACA hires the artist gives the students ideas. The town has given them a location and kind of a medium choice. That doesn't mean that they're married to that, just means that's what we envision for that spot. But they'll come back with the final piece. In this case, we looked at, you know, can you do a mural on this wall? Well, they came back with even more. They came back with a textural mural that also has the QR codes where you can get some information off of it as well. So, again, we'll work on that process. I think that we were fairly transparent on that process with regard to, again, SACA managing and reaching out to the community. And they do that for others as well. They've had open houses in the past, but they found through COVID they had a winning process that they had ironed out, and I forget which jurisdiction that was, but we utilized the same process for Oro Valley. And I think there was a lot of complaints that we received during the initial inception of the art piece, because again, it was raw. There were different people that had different connotations about where it was going, and we heard a lot of opinions on that. And then ever since that it's been finalized, quite frankly, I haven't heard a peep outside of every now and again a resident will tell me they like the art piece. So that's essentially what I have.
Vice Mayor Barrett.
Okay, thank you. That's the reason I wanted to go second after Councilmember Jones-Ivy is because I was going to approach it from a different angle, and that is with the zoning code. So you mentioned the zoning code. Going back to when I was previously on the Planning and Zoning Commission, art used to go through a development review process. Mm-hmm. That was eliminated. And the zoning administrator was able to then approve administratively art. I think we should go back to the public administration process, the public participation process, now that we've seen some of the results. And so in terms of just not feeling like there's been adequate public participation. So whether that's the town council or otherwise, one that I wanted to mention is that our zoning code states that in our 1% for public art shall not reflect or include advertising elements of a business or corporation, including colors, graphics, logos, or other representation of corporate identity. And yet, another one that I heard a lot of chatter about on social media and otherwise is the self-storage facility on Oracle Road. So we have this requirement that the public art shall have no advertising elements of the business. And then we have a public art piece, which is a person burdened down with packages for a self-storage facility. And it's right directly next to the extra space storage sign. And the code says, including colors, and yet the largest package on the public art is the identical color as the extra space storage sign, which is identically next to it. And so it feels to me that this didn't go through a public approval process. I heard a lot about it online that, you know, whether people cared for it or not, some people did, some people didn't, like we all know happens with public art, right? But either way, I don't really feel personally like it went through that process, or even, in my opinion, like it quite meets the requirement in terms of a lack of advertising elements. So my request would be that we come back with changing the zoning code back to where we have a public participation process, and kind of be able to take a look at these things a little stronger. In terms of public art, and if it were to come to council or go through a public participation process, because of the public meeting nature of it, that inherently lets, you know, people have an opportunity to participate, to find out what's going to be there. So I don't at this point have all the details of how that works, but I know that's something we used to do because we did it before. So I'd like to go back to that. That's my opinion.
Any other questions, comments on this discussion item? Okay. Hearing none, thank you, Mr. Kiesler. We appreciate it. Thank you, Councilmember Green and Councilmember Solomon, for bringing this to the agenda. We'll go to item six. Mr. Standish?
Discussion regarding progress of the Hawk signal on Naranja Drive, just west of La Cholla Boulevard.
So this item was requested by Councilmember Bowen and Councilmember Nicholson. I'll turn the floor over to Councilmember Bowen.
Yes, thank you very much. As a nearby resident of Ironwood Ridge High School, I'm somewhat familiar with the challenges that we have over there. And I was just, I think it's very good for us to always take advantage of opportunities to update the public on progress of projects that are going on, and for them to hear the details, what is going well, what are the challenges, and when can we expect to be completed. So that was basically my request. I think this is an important part of our infrastructure, and I'd like to find out from the staff how you feel like the construction is going.
Mayor, Councilmember Bowen, we're done. That's why. But what I can do is I have a video here. Let's go ahead. Could we, if you watch on your screens, there it is, September 1st. That's my staff. And just to give you a little highlight of this, there were challenges with this. The biggest challenge was timing. We put a signal up in 2 months. You don't do that. Yeah, that was fast. And the reason it was so fast was what we did. We ended up doing a solar and a radio-linked signal. And we were able to get all the pieces. Now, some of them we had, like the poles, we actually had those. I had to order them. They were a year out. So we are going to order to backstock those poles. Like, I have my fingers crossed that we don't go ahead and have any instance where I need a pole. Otherwise, we'll have to beg, cheat, and steal to get something from City of Tucson or Pima County. But in the meantime, we're done. It's working. We became operational September 1st. We're going to, and just to give the council some peace of mind, we will continue after things settle down and it's ordinary and the kids have gotten into the groove of using it or not. We'll go back out there and do more counts to see if it does comply with warrant. And the other thing is that we're looking at educational materials as well. There's a lot of materials out there on this, and we're kind of sorting through what's the best one. We want to reach out with regard to a couple things. One, for the students at both Ironwood and Wilson, that they understand how the signal works. And then another, maybe an update for the town populace in general, those who drive cars, Here's a new hawk, and just a refresher on how do you drive through a hawk. You know, when do you stop? When it's a hard stop? When's it a stop and you're allowed to move through with caution? You know, just get the details out. Again, not to insult anybody, but just as a refresher, we can all use it.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you very much, Paul. Job well done.
That's really wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Kiesler. That's incredible that that was accomplished in 2 months and that you had those poles in stock. We'll go to now item three, Mr. Standish.
Discussion regarding light pole protocols at Naranja Park.
So this item was requested by Councilmember Green and Councilmember Bowen. Councilmember Green, you have the floor.
Mayor, based on advice of legal counsel, I would move that the council adjourn into executive session in order to obtain legal advice on this crucial issue.
And are you wanting to invite the town manager, deputy town manager, town attorney, chief civil deputy attorney, and the town clerk?
Yes.
Okay, I Please. Second. Any discussion? We'll go into executive session. The vote, excuse me. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed, nay. The ayes have it, 7-0. Thank you, Vice Mayor. We'll resume the regular session. Are there any future agenda items? Vice Mayor Barrett?
Maybe this relates to Councilmember Solomon's earlier agenda item, but I'll just add it. I would like to have an opportunity for discussion and possible direction regarding the design and public participation process for the bond-funded amenities.
Second.
Okay. Seconded by Councilmember Nicholson. Other future agenda items? Hearing none, I move to adjourn.
Second.
Seconded by, I'm not sure who, Vice Mayor Barrett. Councilmember Jones-Ivy. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Ayes have it. Good night.